You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the S E A. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the S E A.
Hello and welcome to episode 463 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast, sponsored by our friends at Pagliacci Pizza. I'm your co-host Kevin Pelton,
and I'm Tristan Caracino.
And we're coming to you in separate locations. I'm in Seattle, Washington, home of the AL West leading Seattle Mariners.
Oh, I'm so mad you get to do that. And I'm coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks. Who cares? Like this is a baseball podcast, people.
In a city with a little more important teams. I was thinking about like our Mariners fandom the other day and how we went on a podcast that with the series name was Why I'm a Mariners Fan. And we were invited on this podcast and we talked about how we are not Mariners fans.
Is that incredible?
We're not Mariners fans.
I think the Mariners might be number two for me in the pecking order of caring.
UW football?
UW football's number one.
Yeah. Although in that episode, I did predict that I would jump on the bandwagon hard.
There we go.
So a rare good prediction.
We just had to get enough years away in the post-Ichiro era.
Oh, God.
We had to get enough
years. Don't connect me with the Ichiro part of it. I had to get enough years removed from the street vacation vote.
Yeah, that's still not great. But at least there's a... Oh, no.
But at this point, the reason that there's not an NBA team here no longer has anything to do with the city of Seattle.
Yeah.
It's not on us. The ball is literally in your court, NBA. I don't know if it's figuratively in your court. I guess it's not literally in their court. All right. We're not going to talk about that today. Let's get into our toast. Into it. Congratulations to Sounders goalkeeper Stephen Fry, who made his 400th appearance for the Sounders across all competitions Saturday against St. Louis City SC, extending his own club record, first player in franchise history to reach 400 appearances. Obviously, a little easier to do that for a goalkeeper, given you're out there basically every game and the longevity at the position. But still, this is one that's not going to be threatened for a long period of time.
And do you think he found out like mid-game that there was a team called St. Louis SC? Or that made you snort?
It was I was drinking.
You spit out your water?
It's a good thing it was water.
I guess. What else would it have been? What?
Well, back in the day, I don't know if you're aware of this. We used to drink beer on this podcast.
What would have been the difference?
I could have gotten on my computer.
Water getting on your computer, it's a liquid.
Okay, I guess that's bad.
What are you talking about? Computers are famously allergic to beer. What?
I wouldn't want it to smell.
Oh, my God.
Tough question. It's the next storm game I go to.
You got to do the freaking home of the ALS leading Seattle Mariners, so turnabout's fair play.
Do you think Stephen Fry only hears about the other teams during the roundup?
Yeah.
I bet he's got...
Let's get to a real toast coming up next year.
Season pass, whatever they call it on Apple. Congrats to Andres Munoz, named AL Reliever of the Month for April.
There we go.
When he did not allow a run during the month in 15 appearances, allowing just 7 base runners with 19 strikeouts and recording 11 saves.
Incredible performance. I Googled Andres Munoz Cy Young odds. Famously, was not on the list. But
were any relievers on the list?
I don't think so, no. So two MLB rules things that I have to bring up. Number one.
Okay. I didn't know this was going to be a segment. I wasn't prepared for MLB rules.
Count if it is in extra innings with a runner on second, it should not count as an earned run.
It doesn't count as an earned run.
It doesn't?
No, it's treated as an earned run. But he did not give up any such runs.
Yeah, he did.
Well, okay. Yes. In May, he did. In April, he did not.
In April, yes. Okay, so
when I first heard this stat.
Run. So Andres Munoz still has not given up an earned run this season.
Well, no, the other runs in that inning were earned.
That wasn't Munoz. He got out of the inning. It was the next inning.
Oh, that was the 11th. You're right. Okay, yes. No, you're correct. Yes, still no earned
runs. Okay, so Munoz is still at zero. Okay, thank you. Thank you, MLB stat makers. I am down for that. I'm triple checking you're right, though, because I don't believe you.
I'm 100% right on that rule. Whether I'm right about it, how it's applied to
You're
Andres Munoz.
famously untrustworthy about stats.
I'm looking at it now. Runs one, earned runs zero.
Okay. Wipe the sweat from my brow for okay. Andres Munoz.
Yes.
Number two, children's baseball this weekend.
Okay.
They're runners on first and third. Ironically, this
were
is
you
my...
umpiring?
No. This is older children's baseball. They do not let me. I did, however, umpiring punch out my own child today. And then
oh,
I came
no.
I or not today, sorry. This last weekend. I came back after the inning and they were like, those were definitely balls. I was like, with two strikes, you gotta be swinging at those pitches. We're learning baseball here. You can't take those pitches if they're that close to two strikes. Sorry. Anyway, this is a you make the call. You remember those baseball cards?
Oh, I do remember those. There was also like, I believe there's a book of like wacky scenarios in baseball. Something like that.
This is like, it's kind of a genre on TikTok that there's like plays that you have to make the call on. It's fun. I always want to make the call. I'm wrong like 60% of the time. Anyway, there is no outs, one out maybe. There's less than two outs. How about that? There are runners on first and third. Ironically, my child is the one who is at play in the rule that I disputed. a little bit more concerned about this. So a runner on third, my child hits a deep fly ball, right?
Okay.
To a fielder, it's going to be caught.
It is?
So the runner,
okay.
the runner from
oh, the
third
older children.
Is going,
Sorry, older children.
Going to score. These are 12U players. They're able to catch fly balls. The runner from third would score in the situation on a sac fly. However, the older players, this was not a very good team they're playing. The ball hits the fielder's glove and he drops it. How do you score that play for the hitter?
I don't know that you can assume that it's going to be a run scoring sacrifice fly, even if we all know it's going to be a run scoring sacrifice fly. So I would say it was not.
Wrong ruling. You can assume in a situation when it is an error, you should still, it is ruled an error for the defender, but a sack fly for the hitter. Okay. Ruled incorrectly in the game changer. I'm not a crazy enough person that I was going to go tell anybody to change it. Because I don't even know if there's a way to do that in Game Changer. But I definitely, after this, looked up the rule and after explained it to my child. And he said, nerd.
Oh, bring Luca on the phone.
I was like, this matters, people. You weren't credited with an RBI when you should have gotten an RBI.
You need more of your children on the pod to roast you.
Anyway.
Well, speaking of watching your children excel on the diamond, congrats to Big Ten Freshman of the Week Alexis DeBoer, who hit 500 with two home runs and three RBI in the Huskies series win at Penn State with her dad, Galen, in attendance, spotted in the crowd on Sunday during the series finale, chatting it up with Penn State coach James Franklin.
I love it.
It was quite wild. So we'll have
I mean,
more
of course
on that.
He was talking, like, who else would he talk to there?
But James Franklin doesn't necessarily attend every softball game, I'm pretty confident.
I feel like Kalen probably texted him and was like,
I'm
hey, I'm
sure.
going to
yeah.
the game today.
Yeah.
I'm going to come hang. Coaches like to talk to each other.
They do. But it's still fun. I mean, you've got, you know, there's not that many coaches in the SEC and Big Ten. For two of them to be in the same softball stadium is still pretty notable. Lastly, this week on a more somber note, we're remembering Dick Cruz, the first black men's basketball player at UW who died at age 89. The Garfield High School product walked on to integrate the team in 1955, playing three seasons and starting as a senior. So certainly a legendary figure in UW men's basketball history. All right, with that, it is time for your favorite segment.
Don't burn yourself. We got Mariners hot takes coming at ya.
I want to talk about something that often comes up when talking about the Mariners. Mortality. So I was thinking about something that Cousin Sal actually said after the Super Bowl, which was, what do we have left? 30, 40 more Super Bowls? 30, 40 more summers in our life? I'm turning a milestone age in a few weeks. I eat a lot of Pagliacci pizza. And looking at America's current Secretary of Health, that life expectancy may be going way down. I've also been listening to a lot of Warren Zevon lately. one of the greatest American songwriters, and, as an aside, someone who hates spoiled rich kids almost as much as I do, present company included. But if I go when he goes, that's another 16 years for me. And of course, you remember one of his most famous quotes, having been diagnosed with terminal lung cancer and less than a year prior to his death, when asked by David Letterman what he had learned after the diagnosis, Zevon responded, "You're reminded to enjoy every sandwich." Which brings me to the Seattle Mariners. We've got, what, 30, 40 more Mariners seasons left? I've seen hand-wringing about whether this start can continue, or worry about the price of player extensions in 1 to 2 years. And my brother, I would like to remind you this is a game, a pastime for America, if you will. And for me and us, we've all got different amounts of time left. It could be 50 years. It could be tomorrow. But what we do have tomorrow is another baseball game. And then 3 more this weekend. And right in front of us, one of the most fun Mariners teams of all time. We get to see Cal Raleigh, Julio Rodriguez, Jorge Polanco, and Randy Arozarena almost every single day. And also every one of those days, we get to see one of the Gas brothers. This team is fun right now. Even when they lose, it is a pleasure. And so if it doesn't continue in July, August, whatever, but today, it's May, and we get to see another amazing effort from Cal with a pinch hit to take the lead in the ninth. And do you know what is a sandwich? Because in another man's immortal words, I'm planning to enjoy every grand salami.
Wow. I was expecting a Mitch Witch reference somehow to come up. Or a Ham Swaggerty, perhaps, RIP to both of those.
Oh my God.
T-Mobile Park sandwiches. So you were in the moment after Dan Wilson brought the infield in with one out in the 11th. You were like, you know what? I'm just enjoying this Mariners season.
Honestly, I'm telling you this straight up, maybe the most fun game that I've watched all year, even though the Mariners lost.
I mean, going to 11 innings is inherently fun.
When Munoz struck out those 3 batters in a row with the bases loaded with nobody out, I am telling you, when you see darkness like that, even though they didn't win the game, when you see that level of darkness and come back from it, there is nothing more fun than that. That's why he's AL Reliever of the Month.
Not for me.
You're picking a different player as AL Reliever of the Month?
I'm just saying.
Big Vargas
still,
guy.
Look. Got that safe tonight.
A little dicey. But these two games, watching the Mariners and the A's is actually like they should play a playoff series. I want a Mariners-A's playoff series. It is such a classic A's team that they have right now. Every batter, you're like, this fucking guy, like just straight up top to bottom in the order. They have so many of those. It has never been a more A's team. They've got a pretty good bullpen. Like seeing all those players, I feel like. Like, it feels like it's the early 2000s playing these games against the A's.
Way too many people in the stands for it to feel like the early 2000s A's.
Well, it's a much smaller stand,
It's a joke. The A's during the Moneyball heyday did draw many fans to the Coliseum. So a lot on the line Wednesday in the day game series finale here. The Mariners have won 8 consecutive series, tying their most since 2001. 9 would surpass that. So, or maybe they need 9 to tie. I'm second guessing my own stat here.
I told you, famously not very good at stats.
Did you see today's Alex Meyer game winning stat?
No, what is it?
The last 2 pinch hitters with go ahead RBI in the ninth inning against the A's. Cal Raleigh, his game-winning single tonight, and then Cal Raleigh, September 2022, with the walk-off home run. Was that the clincher?
Since then, they have not had pinch-hit walk-offs? Where pinch-hit take the lead?
Pinch-hit go-ahead RBI in the ninth inning against the A's.
Okay, I'm kind of surprised that they haven't had one of those in that time period, but that's a pretty good stat. That's a good pull.
They always are. Every time I'm amazed. So,
are you a little bit jealous?
Of course.
Okay. If it was that,
I was infuriated when I logged on to Blue Sky after finally finishing. I was behind on the DVR for Timberwolves Warriors, and I had run the R code to see that was the first time in NBA history that all four road teams had won game one of the conference semifinals. But that was already out there. The NBA had disseminated it. I was way too late to the party.
Was it the first time?
Yeah.
I was kind of thinking about that. Wait, as an aside here on the NBA, do you think that this playoffs, because already there were, at least in the West, a couple of upsets in the first round, right? In the East, were there any? There were no upsets in the East, right?
I would say that there was, I guess there were a couple
seed
of upsets.
Is what I'm just talking about. Lower sure. seeded teams winning.
Okay, I mean it's the third time in NBA history that's, which only goes in this case back to 1984, which is when they expanded to 16 times. It's only the third time that we've had a 6-7 matchup in the second round of the playoffs. The other time that happened. Was or the more recent time that happened was 2 years ago. The Warriors and the Lakers were 6-7, and before that, the Sonics were involved in 1987 when they played the Rockets.
Really? Okay. Yeah. Do you think that given that and then the four upsets in Game One, do you think that has any bearing? Like, are any of these teams going to win these series?
Well, I mean, the Indiana Pacers are now up 2-0, and Cleveland's three of Cleveland's top six or seven players missed. Game two to injury. So I got some concerns for the Cleveland Cavaliers. The common denominator in three of the four game one road wins was that the road team shot much better from 3-point range, which is famously a thing that does not sustain itself from one game to another. So like the Celtics, I am particularly unconcerned for, I would say. And
that's a pretty tough series though. Like that Knicks team. Pretty
is
good.
It?
You don't think so? I thought the Knicks were pretty good, but
I mean, they lost every single game they played against Boston, Cleveland, and Oklahoma City in the regular season, most of them by lopsided margins.
Okay. All
so right, I think enough. Boston's going to be. Boston is the team I feel best about their chances. Well, no, Minnesota's probably the team I feel best about their chances of advancing because Steph Curry is injured.
Boston can't be one of the favorites, but.
What do you mean?
Boston is. The lower seeded team? No, they're not.
No, Boston's the higher seeded team. I'm telling you who I feel the best about their chances of advancing is the higher seed teams, despite losing game one.
Oh, I thought, wouldn't you assume that it's all of them?
I mean, I just told you, like, Indiana, I think now is probably the favorite in that series.
Okay.
And Oklahoma City and Denver was not a make or miss league situation.
Denver just outplayed them.
I still think Oklahoma City will win the series because they're the much better team. And
yeah, how much hope should I have? I guess is my question. Steph is injured, and how we don't know how serious that is yet.
I mean, it's a hamstring strain. So likely, you know, the good scenario is probably something on the order of a week. And you know, if he comes back that fast, it's probably going to affect him when he comes back. So,
who is more likely to let's say that OKC advances? Who is more likely to beat them?
I think Minnesota.
Is that true even with a healthy Steph?
Yes.
Okay. I mean, they kind of clobbered them during the regular season a couple times.
They played them well during the regular season. You know, they match up with them pretty well in terms of size and athleticism on the perimeter.
Aren't big men generally considered during the playoffs less useful?
Traditional rim protecting is less useful during the playoffs.
But
Minnesota
Gobert
has other kinds of big men besides that.
Beyond Gobert, you're saying?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, it was just crazy to see, watching the Lakers series, Gobert be such a factor.
I mean, Gobert usually has not been good enough offensively to take advantage of the size differential when teams go small against him. That's the issue. I mean, obviously, he's less valuable defensively when he's on the perimeter than when he's at the rim, because if he's defending on the perimeter, he can't also be helping at the rim.
And so OKC could stretch him out, though, and just they can pull Chet out.
I think Oklahoma City has enough non-shooters that you would be able to put Gobert somewhere else. He would probably not defend Chet almost
and
at
somebody
all
else defend Chet around the yes. perimeter. Okay.
I mean, Julius Randle would defend Chet or Naz Reid when he's playing.
Okay. I'm going to maintain hope here. They're still the prohibitive favorite to win the championship, though.
I think so. I'm curious what the betting odds look like at the present time. Yeah, they're a slight favorite over Boston. So,
Okay.
which Boston now has a clearer path towards having home court for the conference finals. Not that that's make or break for them. But yeah.
Are they're the 3 seed Boston?
No, they're the 2 seed.
Oh, the Cavs are the they're the 2 seed, but the Cavs would be upset. Got it.
Correct. All right, back to the Mariners. Yeah. So, after a lot of bad injury news for a period of time, some encouraging injury news lately. We had on Tuesday night Jorge Polanco making his triumphant return to the field at second
Hello.
base and hitting right-handed against starting against a
Now,
left-handed
I hate to
pitcher.
correct you, but he did play in the field on Monday night.
Oh, did he?
He didn't start, but he played
Okay. He
later in the game.
came in pinch hit and stayed on.
Yes.
Well, okay, starting in the field, playing the duration of this. Dylan Moore
Words
back from
matter.
the IL. And then the Mariners claimed Leody Taveras off waivers from the Rangers on Tuesday. He's making $4.75 million this season, was hitting .241, but with just 2 walks and 82 plate appearances and 5 extra base hits for a .601 OPS, which is why Texas panicking over their loss at the hands of the Mariners, their 2-1 series loss at the hands of the Mariners, in addition to firing their hitting coach, also designated Taveras for assignment. He hit a career high 266 with 14 home run in 2023 when the Rangers won the World Series, including, I don't know if you recall this, homering in the game we attended that J.P. Crawford walked off in the final week of the regular season.
I definitely do not specifically remember that, but I kind of remember Garver from that game, and
I
just
mean,
being like, this
what we were
lineup is nonstop. Like that lineup
exactly.
was scary.
And Taveras was hitting like eighth and hit a home run in that game. So that definitely like it stuck out enough in my mind that I went and looked it up and it turned out to be the case.
I can't believe the A's run differential is -23.
That is kind of bizarre. His average dropped to .229 last season, but with more walks and power than we've seen so far in 2024. Feels like a lot of Victor Robles to this move in terms of, he was never as highly touted as Robles, but Mariners trying to get something more out of a player who was let go by an organization that also needed help offensively, as everyone does. And then a position that has become a much bigger need for them over the period of time. Randy Arozarena in the lineup at DH on Tuesday night. We'll see when he's able to play the field again. Robles out for an extended period of time here. Luke Rayleigh out for an extended period of time. So we're seeing a lot of Miles Mastrobuoni in left field.
I'm okay with it.
I mean, I'm
I
not
think
against it, but I'd like to see him at second base.
I think Robles is the obvious comparison because the timing is pretty similar, and just the positions that they play. But I wouldn't expect the same outcome. I would remain
Are we sure
skeptical,
we should
but
expect the same outcome with Victor Robles?
I also would be skeptical about that.
Right. But like, is Leody Taveras a better option in the outfield than Rylan Thomas? I think the answer is probably yes.
I kind of like some of that Rylan Thomas action.
I don't know how many of his at bats I caught, but even this season, when Taveras has been struggling at the plate, as I mentioned, he still rates his like zero war, like replacement level. And I think that's probably a little better than what you're expecting from the Mariners they're calling up at this point.
Don't scoff at that 0.1 war that Rylan Thomas has accrued.
Oh, okay. No, I credit that 0.1 war. That's 0.1 war more than the vast majority of all baseball players of all time.
In his 10 plate appearances.
The other bit of positive Mariners injury news, George Kirby went 3 innings for the Rainiers in his
Oh,
first rehab
yes.
start on Sunday,
Oh,
allowing one
yes.
run on a solo home run at Las Vegas, a
So
notorious hitter's park.
I think Hancock has kind of established himself, though,
Oh,
as
yeah.
it. I mean, let's say that everybody's back. He's probably out of the rotation, but. Hancock is a he is more than a capable starter. He's a gas brother. Emerson Hancock. He's in the
I
rotation.
mean, I heard on this podcast that I listen to sometimes. I heard last week that he's one of the team's six aces or seven
I
aces.
actually said seven aces.
Now, I think you may, after Logan Evans' last start, be amending it to six aces, back to six aces.
No.
There are no take backs.
There are yeah, there's no look, Emerson Hancock had a bad start to start the year. We didn't take it back. We stuck with Emerson Hancock.
His ERA is still 5.7. It was such a hole that he dug in the opening game.
I mean, the numbers are like, oh, hmm. Oh, what? This doesn't have today on it. Got it.
Baseball Reference?
ESPN doesn't.
Oh.
I don't know why, at least on the game log. I mean, like, his starts haven't been incredible. I mean, since then, you know, he's still giving up a few runs in every game. So, like, it doesn't bring down the ERA as fast as possible. Like, 6 innings, 2-3 runs doesn't bring down the ERA that quickly.
But his FIP entering today, according to Baseball Reference, was 4.42.
There was, I was on TikTok, and Logan Evans' girlfriend had a, like, come with me on a road game as a Mariners girlfriend or whatever. And I was like, yeah, do this now, but, like, maybe don't get too comfortable. Right now, I was like, this is your first ever road trip, but it was like as if it's just like a constant thing. And I was like, we're gonna see how many of these there are for Logan Evans.
You know, he's got a long future ahead of him,
yes.
I would say, Logan Evans, whether that future includes many more starts for the Seattle Mariners in 2025, I'll give that a firm. We'll see.
The hope is probably not, which is not even necessarily an indictment on Logan Evans, it's just as players are getting healthier, you know. Fingers crossed, knock on wood, about player health, but they've withstood a very difficult time. For the Mariners to be playing baseball right now at a clip that people are concerned whether they can keep it up.
I think this concern whether they can keep it up is overstated. I think it is with many things.
Being one of the top five, top 10 teams in baseball.
The backlash to the backlash is greater. I mean, what I enjoyed last week was the national media discovers the Seattle Mariners can hit. Did you also enjoy that storyline?
To be one of the 5 to 10 best teams in baseball, record-wise, and in many ways, and do that with Logan Gilbert missing his last at least 2 starts so far, right?
I mean, and effectively 3 starts. Like, you know, his injury blew up that start.
With Kirby also being out, who, honestly, are probably... I mean, Wu is in that mix as well, but probably your 2 best starters right now.
Yeah.
They're both all-stars last year. To be in that position that the Mariners are in, it is an incredible place to be. And what they've withstood so far, and to have this record, and also some of the batting health as well, like...
I mean, they have the 8th best run differential in baseball. So this is not a fun differential situation. This is not, I mean, you know, they're a little bit behind where they are in terms of record, but it's...
That was part, you know, of what I was margin saying. There. The 7-6 loss yesterday against the A's, what made it so fun, though, was it was like, it's freaking Rylan Thomas out there. You know what I mean? Like, he's making crucial plays. The catch that he made in the corner was, you know, crucial plays. You had Rowdy Tellez, who, obviously, Rowdy's been on a tear lately, but, like, two weeks ago, we were like, this is not a professional baseball player. And all of a sudden, he's hitting 5th.
Define a we.
Oh, come on. You were out there being like, give Rowdy more time.
I believe I'm famous for citing sample size. That is literally my whole shtick, sir.
So to have had like and a pretty brutal start from Bryce Miller as well, and that lineup and be against a good A's team on the road to be there in that position, I thought it was great.
Okay. There you go. Mariners baseball. It's great, even when they lose. As long as it's in extra innings. Anything more in the Mariners?
Nope.
Okay. Well, we'll have plenty more to come on them. As we get into our roundup, I had it wrong last week. The NHL draft lottery was actually Monday night. They held it on Cinco de Mayo, and it was pretty much the worst-case scenario for the Kraken. Dropped 2 spots to 8th.
Oh! So we're going to have extensive scouting on who's available.
Obviously. Yeah. Yeah. Go deep in the weeds on the
you've been watching a lot of WHL, AHL, college hockey, scouting these players, right?
Oh, you really want to get into some of the European leagues as well?
Yes.
For those prospects? All right, Seattle Sounders.
That was it. They're just like, we're good.
That was the lottery. It happened. The draft's next month. We got a ways to go until then. Seattle Sounders exploded for 3 goals after halftime after trading scores with St. Louis City SC from the spot on a pair of late first half penalties a couple of minutes apart there. Definitely a very much a makeup call situation, it felt like, on the Sounders getting a penalty almost immediately after conceding one. Ryan Kent on as a substitute set up Obed Vargas as the Sounders took the lead. Janie Masovsky then scored for the fourth consecutive game, and Nuhu capped the scoring with his second career MLS goal, also created by Kent, who's showing a lot of quality as he works his way into game condition. And part of why that I have almost never in soccer seen a game that was this high scoring that so exactly mirrored the expected goals. It was like 3.9 XG for the Sounders, 1-something for St. Louis City SC. So they completely dominated and controlled the game and got it rewarded and matched on the scoreline as they earned a well-deserved 3 points. They did this without Jordan Morris, who's expected to miss the next 6 weeks after suffering a restrain of his hamstring in his comeback. And then Jesus Ferreira also sat out Saturday for precautionary reasons. They tried not to exacerbate a muscle issue with him. But Sounders still more than holding their own, heading into the start of a brutal three-game week, all on the road, beginning this Saturday at Houston Dynamo. Will be interesting to see if they rotate much against a team that is tied for 13th in the West with the aforementioned St. Louis City. Only the struggling LA Galaxy have a worse goal differential in the West than the Dynamo's -6. And coming up after this, next week, it's games against LAFC and the rival Portland Timbers. So some pretty important matches on tap after this for the Sounders. Seattle Reign also got an impressive win. Lumen Field, a perfect weekend for the home teams, as they got Lynn Biendolo's first goal in a Reign uniform as the only score on Friday, handing the league-leading Kansas City Current their second loss of the season. They took advantage of the absence of Kansas City star Temwa Chiwenga, who subbed on for the final 30 minutes while nursing an injury. Biendolo scored late in the first half, and the Reign absorbed heavy pressure from the Current after Chiwenga came on with a Claudia Adeyemi save in stoppage time, preserving the clean sheet. This Sunday, they'll face the Houston Dash, who are off to a slow start, 12th in the NWSL table with a -4 goal differential. Reign tied for 7th right now. Seattle Storm. Some tough news last week as we learned that Katie Lou Samuelson suffered a season-ending ACL tear in practice last Thursday. Samuelson back with the Storm for the second time after starting for the team in 2021 and figured to be an important part of the rotation with her versatility to play both forward spots and then the shooting ability that she brings to a team that really struggled from beyond the arc last season. So, you know, this injury, the third ACL tear that the Storm have seen coming into this season, Jordan Horston, Nika Mule over the offseason. The difference with this injury, because those injuries happened while players were playing in non-WNBA competition, the Storm were able to place them on the suspended list for the season and therefore take their salaries off the books and clear those roster spots. Because Katie Lou Samuelson was injured playing, you know, in practice for the Storm, she will have to be on the roster. Won't have to be on the roster, but her non-protected salary becomes effectively guaranteed for this season. And what that means is the Storm don't have enough cap space to waive Katie Lou Samuelson and keep another player in that spot. So they essentially have to keep her. And a team that was already looking at starting the season with 11 players instead of the maximum 12 on their roster, now down to 10 healthy players to start the season. And for, you know, much of it until they have the prorated minimum gets low enough that they can then sign a 12th player to fill that spot at some point midway through. Now, there is one way the Storm could potentially, you know, avoid having that roster spot be open, which is if they traded Katie Lou Samuelson to another team who had the cap space to waive her and, you know, take that cap hit and still fill out their roster. They don't have any second round picks to do that in the next couple of years here because they made multiple trades. Do have, you know, 3 first rounders next year, but if you're giving up one of those, I think you're probably going to want to be getting a player who can help you in return in addition to the cap relief. So
how big of an impact do you think that'll have on this current season?
I mean, she was definitely going to be part of the rotation. As I'm, you know, I'm doing my WNBA projections. I don't have a projection for Dominique Malunga because of the fact that, you know, there's no European, I have not looked
off
at
the
European
charts
translations.
The ceiling does not exist. Is that the term? No, the limit does not exist.
The limit, the ceiling is the roof, perhaps the Michael Jordanism. So as a result of that, there's like a lot of minutes to go around for the players who are going to make the Storm's roster right now, without Katie Lou Samuelson in the mix. Alicia Clark becomes even more important with her ability to slide to multiple positions. Same with Gabby Williams. One of the interesting wild cards. So to skip ahead a little bit, Malunga made her debut at Storm practice on Tuesday, and very briefly, the Storm did throw out a lineup where they had Malunga, Ezzie Megbegor, and Neko Gumake all on the court at the same time. Perhaps inspired by the Houston Rockets throwing out multiple post players in their series against the Warriors.
Were you watching? Were you there?
I was there at this point, yeah.
How was it?
It was very brief. There was nothing to take from it. And
nothing. You saw nothing?
Malunga was jet-lagged. In the part of practice we saw, looked like definitely a 19-year-old who's practicing in the WNBA for the first time. But it's certainly something I think that Noel Quinn's going to have to take a look at. So that's one way potentially you could fill in some of those minutes. Then it also does kind of affect where the Storm go with their 11th roster spot. We had been thinking sort of a combo guard might have been the most likely player, which, they have Zaya Cook in camp, who's from South Carolina, played the last 2 years from the LA Sparks. They drafted Serena Sundell from Kansas State with their top third-round pick this year. She's the only of their three third-round picks left in camp after they waived Madison Connor and Jordan Hobbs on Tuesday. But, now maybe that need is more at the 3-4 spots, which could help last year's third-round pick, McKenzie Holmes, who sat out the year to have knee surgery. She was the most impressive of this group on Sunday when the Storm played their lone preseason game, comfortably beating a Connecticut Sun team that's going to be one of the league's worst this season and had several of their key players absent for this one.
Really? That's it? Why do they only play one preseason game?
They are playing... It's actually very similar to college basketball, I would say, this year. They are playing the Sparks next Saturday, I believe it is, in LA, but it is behind closed doors rather than being considered a preseason game.
Why?
There's some financial reason that the LA Sparks had for that, I'm sure.
Okay.
And,
fair enough.
It's also the same reason that, NFL teams like doing the training
practices.
You can control the situation more than you can in a preseason game where it's got to be played according to WNBA rules.
Okay, fair enough.
So like I said, McKenzie Holmes was a standout in that one. Lee Yeru started at center because Ezzie Megbegor and Gabby Williams had not participated in the first week of training camp and didn't play in the preseason game as they sort of ramp up after their long European seasons. Just kind of working them in slowly. They practiced for the first time on Tuesday and looked like, they picked up where they left off, certainly. But that created an opportunity for Lou Yeru to start at center in this one and really dominated down in the paint, exactly the Storm was hoping to see from her at 6'7", as someone who's still kind of growing into her WNBA game, took a major step forward last year with the Sparks. So very exciting, kind of the front court depth that the Storm potentially has. It was kind of interesting with those two players out. They started Erica Wheeler alongside Skylar Diggins, a pair of point guards. Probably not something you're going to see a lot of, but certainly indicates that Erica Wheeler is a veteran, even though, she's on what is technically a training camp contract. She pretty comfortably is as Lee. Both of them, I think, can feel pretty confident about their chances of making the team. It's probably those four players and anyone else they might consider picking up for that one last spot on the roster, barring a trade. So Malunga, there was a little bit of concern last week because he didn't have a timetable for her return. She flew into Seattle on Saturday night from France, was at the preseason game on Sunday on the bench in street clothes, and then after passing her physical and all that testing on Monday, went through her first practice Tuesday. Before they let the media in, she did dunk in a drill, which the Storm ended up posting on social media. So.
Oh, yeah.
This is like the start of a new era here with a 19-year-old number 2 overall pick. Very exciting times.
I mean, she's easily like every update that there is on Dominique Malunga. That's what we want to know about.
People are into it. It's
going to be one of those things where there could be a slight glimpse of something and we are going to be hyped on it.
I do think expectations for this season need to be reasonable.
But that's 19 years old. You don't have to have expectation. All we want to see is something.
And
it doesn't have to be amazing play.
is a dunk in a game, which the Storm have never had.
Really?
I don't think so. Unless I'm missing someone, they definitely have not had one in franchise history.
It's just you're looking for those glimpses. I mean, we remember, right? Big Bob Smith or Bob Swift, and those moments where it's just like with young players. Obviously, he developed into a great player. But no, he would have been a star without the injuries.
Convinced of it.
But
not a star, but he would have been a very good player.
With those players, you're like, just show me something right now. Show me something exciting. Like, you don't have to contribute right away.
I mean, I think of Ezzie Magbegor, when she came over for the 2020 Wubble season, she was actually a year older than this because after, like Malunga, getting drafted at age 19, sat out that first year. You know, Storms kept her rights, stashed her in Australia. But her debut, Storm on national TV against the New York Liberty, she switches out on rookie Sabrina Ionescu, the number one pick in the draft, and just absolutely stones her on a switch and shows the athleticism that has helped make her one of the best defensive players in the league. So, you know, that's the kind of moments I'm looking for. Not necessarily that specifically, but that sort of thing. So, like I mentioned, Storm have that preseason game, that preseason scrimmage on Saturday. Then next week, we'll have to cut down their roster to 11 players before the start of the season. So we will stay tuned there. UNUM softball took 2 of 3 at Penn State to wrap up the regular season. They worked extra innings to win 9-5 on Friday, getting 4 runs in the top of the ninth, then lost 7-5 on Saturday, but bounced back Sunday to run rule the Nittany Lions 8-0, getting that pair of home runs from Alexis DeBoer and a shutout from Sophia Ramuno. The Huskies will enter their first Big Ten tournament to be played in West Lafayette. Indiana is the number 7 seed facing number 10 seed Indiana on Wednesday afternoon. The winner will face number 2 seed UCLA in Thursday's quarterfinals. Huskies are probably safely in the NCAA tournament, regardless of the result this weekend. They are number 34 in softball RPI, not among the last 4 in at collegesportsmadness.com last week. Don't really know exactly where they are because you only have the 16 host teams for the regionals get seeded. Everyone else is just unseeded. But, you know, I would assume they're something like the equivalent of a 9 or a 10 seed, if we think about this in college basketball terms, where we're a little more familiar with what these 64 teams look like. Huskies have only missed the NCAA tournament in 1993, their first year as a program.
Wow, that's crazy.
I didn't quite realize it was that long a streak until I went and looked it up. Well, doing it for the rundown, UNUM baseball took 2 of 3 from Iowa.
Hello.
Locking off both wins.
I thought they swept the series.
They did not sweep the series. Via what they're calling Montlake Magic. First on Friday night, with a Blake Wilson butt bringing home Malachi Knight from third, a la Carlos Guillen in the 2000 ALDS. Wilson, like Guillen, safe at first.
I don't know any of the words that you just said.
Mariners against the White Sox in game 3 of the
ALDS.
They
played the White Sox in a playoff series?
They did. Completed the sweep.
You could have asked me who they played in that playoff series and given me 14 guesses, and I would have been wrong.
You would have somehow said the Brewers, even though they may still have been in the AL at that point. I don't know. It was I remember being on campus at UW for that series, and a very, very thrilling moment. My first quarter at UW. And then more conventionally walking it off on Saturday night with a 2-run homer by Colton Bauer.
We have so many walk-offs. We have conventional and unconventional walk-offs.
Exactly.
There we go.
Hawkeyes then shut the Huskies out 8-0 in Sunday's series finale. Huskies still hanging on to fifth in the Big Ten standings at 15-9 ahead of this weekend's visit to Eugene to face the 16-8 Ducks. So if they can take 2 out of 3, they could catch Oregon in the stand-ins.
Wow.
So percolating on Montlake with UW baseball.
Okay.
I admit I was skeptical.
How many more games are left?
They have 3 more series.
Three more series?
USC, UCLA, and Oregon, I believe.
Okay, got to do a lot of winning very soon. Again, I looked at on 3 field of 64 projections for Bubble Watch. The headline, field of 64 projections. Chaotic week shifts NCAA tournament picture, strengthens bubble. And I'm like, UW right there. So you're telling me there's a chance. And then I scrolled at first. I was like, I'm sure I'm going to be seeing the name. I didn't see the name for a little while, and then I did a little command F and W 1 out of 45. We're gonna do this every week. A 1 out of 18. S 1 out of 3 was chaotic.
Oh no.
And when you get to the H, it is 0 out of 0. So still not mentioned by On3. Put some respect on the Diamond Dog's name, On3.com.
To correct my own update, they have 2 series remaining. They have already faced UCLA, but
they're
going
to need to do a
USC.
a lot of winning very quickly. Is there a tournament? Is there a conference tournament?
It does not appear there is. It is not shown on the schedule. Also, their game on Monday against Warner Pacific was suspended. I'm perplexed by that because it certainly was not due to
Warner Pacific was scared.
I was outside. I am confident it was not rain was the issue here. I have not, you know, I didn't really want to get into the UW baseball because there's still a little time left. But let's say
Warner Pacific University. This sounds pretty suspect, and I Googled it, and I stand by what I just said. There was a college that was advertising behind in the A's game, and I was just like, Luca was like, it has to be a Grand Canyon type situation, and I'm like, I didn't look it up. I don't want to know, but I guarantee you that is the case.
The game was suspended due to technical difficulties with the stadium lights.
At UW?
Yeah.
Or the crappy Warner Pacific University Stadium?
UW was not traveling to Warner Pacific. Presumably Warner Pacific was here to play Seattle Pacific. It would be my assumption. And then that stuck around
seems
for the
like
extra game.
Fair enough. I like that they were just like, fuck it, the lights don't work. Go home.
I mean, come on. What are you going to do at that point? A continuation of the game has not been scheduled.
Former Pacific Bible College.
No, I guess that's not true. It was a one-off game for Warner Pacific, whose season is otherwise over.
Yeah.
They just traveled up here to play UW. Okay.
Oh my God.
Where is Warner Pacific exactly?
It is in Portland, Oregon.
Okay. Wow. I guess I should know that.
Well, I don't think there's a students 410.
Huh. That's that's less than you know what school I was looking up the other day was University Prep.
Uh-huh.
You familiar with that? You know where that's located?
It's right across the street from my old house.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. I went and spoke at a class on the music industry at University Prep when I was. I don't even think I worked. No, I was like an intern.
You were at Rainy Dog Radio?
Yeah.
Huskies are 71st in RPI. So, yeah, definitely some work to be done the next 2 weekends here.
University Prep, there's like legit, like that's a legit school.
It's got many more than 410 students.
Don't mention them in the same sentence as Warner Pacific.
I'm just for contrast. I'm saying they're a high school and they have many more students than that.
Did you see the school that I'm talking about that was at the advertising and the like?
No,
I wish I would have looked it up.
If you're aware of this, it was watching 2 NBA playoff games while the Mariners game was going on.
Well, anyway, I think we would have beaten the shit out of the former Pacific Bible College. So you're lucky, Warner Pacific, that the lights didn't work.
Oregon is 24th in RPI, USC 29th. So an opportunity to move up, I would say. But which part of, okay, Southeast 68th, Warner Pacific?
You're looking at the address.
Right by Mount Tabor Park. Okay. That's a good spot to be in.
We understand the geography of Portland better than most of Seattle.
I don't know if I'd go that far. But it is.
It's
no
an okay city in an otherwise bad state.
It is no Reed College, I would say. All right, UW football.
Send the pilots up here, and I'm okay with it.
The spring game was Friday. Hello. You, sir, were there.
Yes, I was.
Our correspondent live on the scene. Tell us about it. How was the Corgi race?
Well, let me tell you. It was a UW football event. So, therefore, it was a shit show. brought to you by UW football. For some reason, they required tickets to a free event. Where I'm like, there can't be concern that you're going to have like 77,000 people show up.
No, I think it was so
event.
That they can count the number that are there because Jed Fish wants to tell
just
how many people
click,
are coming.
Do a little click on the way in because the thing was there were a lot less people in the building because a lot of people were downloading tickets on their way into the building and waiting to scan them. So that was an annoying little
You know
pizza.
The thing about UW football's crowd is it's a notoriously tech-savvy crowd.
I was just like there and I was like, do we actually have to do this? Like scan this thing for the tickets? Which, whatever. I mean, look, they had enough people who
you
wanted
barely
to
have
go.
To scan the tickets for a
game. No, I actually scanned more tickets for this game. I only scanned 4 out of the 5, to be honest, and that's about normal for a game. But sometimes I only show 3 tickets going into look this. And also, they funneled everything to one entrance. So, you know, we feel very comfortable over in the East End zone. And
if I don't see the softball stadium next to me while I'm entering the football game, then what am I even doing?
Look, we're on the same page. That those are beautiful bathrooms. We know the area. We love the area.
I noticed there were like 4 people in the East End zone as I was watching the broadcast.
I think there are people. So there's like suites that are underneath the East End zone now. Right. Was that true last year?
That's always been true since they renovated it. Yes.
Wait, really?
Yeah.
On that very bottom area?
I believe the listener was in one of those suites. Were they not?
They were. Yeah. No, I saw that. So anyway, I missed the entire. And also we had to go to Pagliacci. Shouts to a sponsor, Pagliacci. I think I found my favorite Pagliacci pizza. You would hate it. It's also customized. But so I do the PSR. I don't eat sausage, so I take off the sausage.
Okay, and then I was going to say, the Storm preseason game, Pagliacci pregame. And, you know, it's not as fresh as I would like it to be because obviously they have to deliver it long beforehand for other people that are used close to game time. But had the PSR on Sunday. And
oh, the PSR.
Got
PSR.
The last spot, and it hit the spot.
Unstoppable. So knowing the Storm employees, they probably crushed the cheese. The double pepperoni crushed that. Nothing, a GOG primo was untouched.
It 100% was.
Was it actually? Oh my God.
I don't know that I can identify the agog primo from some of the other vegetarian options.
Like, the most recognizable one. It has giant chunks of garlic on it.
Wow.
It's a beautiful pizza.
So does the Italiano. There wasn't an Italiano slice there. You did not seem like it held up quite as well. But is when it's fresh, the Italiano, top notch.
But so I did the PSR. I removed the S. Basically, I just like ricotta cheese on pizza. And then I added pepperoni and ricotta. I mean, and then
You added more ricotta?
No. I added onions and mushrooms to it. And it was I think, my favorite Pagliacci pizza I've ever had.
Huh.
Yeah.
It would not be my favorite pizza, but...
No, I mean, those people, they know how to make a pizza.
But anyways.
Do you know what we're doing this weekend for Luca's birthday? Did Jan inform you?
On Friday night?
Yeah. She's getting, what is the place called?
I don't know. This is Dynamite Podcasting.
The Pizza Gallery in Berrien. Do you know that place?
Yes.
Oh, have you ever had it before?
I have.
I don't think I've ever had it. I'm really excited for this. She said there's a giant pizza. Berrien is a hotbed for pizza somehow.
It unquestionably is.
Because I was like, there's this place there. And I was saying it as if it was new and they've existed since 1992.
I didn't realize it was that long.
But I'm pretty hyped on that. You also need to bring a Pagliacci pizza, though.
Of course.
So anyway, I'm happy to know that things haven't changed among Storm employees and staff. And time is a flat circle. I would have been there all alone if I was still employed by the Storm. Hire me back. And I would have happily been eating that agog. Anyway, so I didn't see the first half of this game.
The first half? Okay, so you did not see DeMond Williams Jr.
play football. It's 12 minutes. It's a running clock.
I was thankful for it as I was trying to fast forward through that as quickly as possible. I got home at 9:30 last night. And between then and midnight, wanted to watch the second half of Thunder Nuggets and then also the scrimmage. So there was a lot of fast forwarding going on.
I thought you were going to describe a movie when you said Thunder Nuggets, Days of Thunder Nuggets. but
NBA matchups, but make it a movie.
I will say, so I have a couple of thoughts on football, but more thoughts on the vibes. It was a beautiful day in Seattle, Washington. Oh. Jed Fish's thing about everybody's getting rid of spring games across the country. A person who might have watched the softball team this weekend. And Jed Fish's thing being like, we're bringing it back and we are doing it bigger than ever. The balls on this man. I love Jed Fish. It was packed. And I will tell you who it was packed with. A group of people that you do not see at games all that often. Students from the University of Washington.
What? They have interest in football?
Droves. I am telling you, this team right now, we know that they are probably not as good as the team 2 years ago, but the vibe and the energy around the program, how they ended last season, I thought I was the only one. But there is a lot of energy. Just Denzel coming back, Jonah coming back, what Damon did at the end of the season. And it is like, we're kind of running it back here in the same way. We had a non-existent draft, quiet draft. Team from down south, very busy draft. They, of course, scheduled nobody. But somehow the Big Ten is rigged and they have no good teams on the schedule. But how about I take that back? They have one good team on the schedule.
Oh, there it is.
But the whole energy around University of Washington football is incredible right now. And it was never more electric than at halftime with the Corgi race.
There it is. It's all a prelude to the Corgi race.
Did they show that on the broadcast?
They showed highlights of it. So apparently there was a series of Corgi heats.
Yes.
Was there semifinals, or was it just from the four heats directly to the final?
The heats into the final.
Okay.
I think there were only two heats, and then the two winners faced off against each other. So I will say, some of the Corgi owners, I think they sacrificed, which I'm not saying this is the wrong way to do it.
So you're saying Penn State is not a good team, for the record?
Are they on the team from down south plays them?
Yes.
Well, they don't play either Ohio State or Michigan, and we have to play both.
That is correct.
Do they host Penn State?
They do not.
Okay. I mean, Penn State's going to obliterate them. That team's going to be really good. They're the actual best team.
Kellen DeBoer was giving some notes to James Franklin about how to beat the team from down south. You know, as much slander as you like to throw at Kellen DeBoer, undeservedly, is a reminder that he is still undefeated.
Was Michael Penix there giving him notes? Michael Penix wasn't there.
Hopefully
he was in
Seattle, Washington.
He was in Seattle, Washington. But I will say, some of the Corgi owners, they sacrificed style for speed out there. So there were Corgis with different outfits on, Corgis with like GoPros on them, which made for very good engaged, I'm sure, videos on TikTok and Instagram Reels and YouTube Shorts. However, those Corgis didn't race as well. And there were a few Corgis, including my boy Gigi, who was all about the W, like you should have been in this one. It was an incredible performance. And I will say, I've not seen it since a victory, you wouldn't know about this, a victory against Michigan last year, been that electric inside of Husky Stadium as it was for the Corgi race.
Not even when Damon Williams Jr. came out in the second half against UCLA.
No, it was UCLA. Come on, get the hell out of here. Give me a Corgi race. In fact, I the Corgi races are so fun. I think ESPN, the Ocho, like, somebody should televise Corgi. It would get too serious, though.
Exactly.
Like, you have to have
It'd
the
get
exact
dark
right
real
amount.
Real soon.
Yeah, no, that's not. But I feel like if you could just have it be fun,
they do have a history of racing dogs. It's not great. It's not a thing you want to endorse. But I take your point.
Fine.
Recreational dog racing is fun. Fly dogs, you know, the point is not necessarily to win the race. The point of fly dogs is a halftime act, but it is still a very fun halftime entertainment.
Really, people cheered for everybody. It wasn't like just the great, because the chaos is also part of the fun.
Of course, yeah. Sometimes like a dog will stop and defecate on the arena court. Like, you know, that's part of the fun.
I love that. So you'll have to tell me how Damon did. I think he threw four passes. Because I have no idea.
It must have been more than that. I didn't go back and double check his final stat line. I don't really care, to be honest.
No, I don't care at all. The defense seems good. I will say, I was thinking, so Dash Beerley, second half, we've got a classic matchup, two freshman quarterbacks. I mean, literally, it's like fight to the death. One of these dudes, maybe both of them are going to be gone next year.
None of them are going to die.
One of them is going, it's for a roster spot. One of them is going to be playing for Portland State next year, and one of them might still be at UW. And I was thinking about Dash Beerley, and I was like, he went to Modern Day. He's probably lost one football game in his life, two football games. It can't be that many, right?
I don't know. I think they're not quite as dominant as they once were, but
maybe not. But like, the amount of times that Dash Beerley has been like beaten up in a game, quarterback, can't be that many. And it was like a rude awakening for Dash Beerley out there. However, from Hawaii, Keeney McMillan looked excellent. And also,
he looked frankly a lot like Damon Williams Jr. looked in last year's spring game. That was awesome. My takeaway.
Hitting Raiden Vane's bright for the touchdown. That was definitely out of bounds. But Jed Fish was like, we're keeping it. It's a touchdown. Jed on the field, just like giving up a little. He was just overseeing, right? Yeah. He was kind of like emceeing the whole thing. Jonah Coleman kicking an extra point. I think Jed was trying to have it be as fun as possible. Like, the quarterbacks could be touched and tackled in this game, I think.
Only during the second half.
Okay.
So this is part of what you missed.
Got it. I was a little bit like, wow, they're letting the quarterbacks get it. And he's like fucking Keeney McMillan, whatever, tackle him. But
for the record, by the way, it's Dash Byerly.
That's how I probably pronounced it. I said Byerly, didn't I? Did I say Beerly?
I think you did.
I was trying to pronounce it right. but just the attitude that Jed has out there, there's something so different about him. And I understand the previous coach, he won more games at UW. He is a phenomenal coach. At least in his time.
We do not have to call him the previous coach. Kalen DeBoer.
No, that's fine. It's not like an insulting the previous coach. I'm just saying Jed has such an attitude about him. Whereas like this freaking dude, if it works, it's really going to work. And I see why people are like, wow, I'm scared about Jed going off, because he has that energy. Well, you know, it's just like Jed, he belongs on a big stage.
He worked
under Pete Carroll, and you could feel it.
We'll get to the momentum that the Huskies are building off the field in a bit, but let's keep focus on the spring game for now. So, Demond Williams Jr. started for the purple team. Tulane transfer Kai Horton started for the gold team. Both of them played in the first half, and that's when it was played under traditional touch rules for the quarterback. And the thing that really stood out, and it's interesting because I mean, I watched Demond Williams Jr. in last year's spring game when he played extensively, and it didn't feel quite the same way, but it was really like, well, these rules don't make any sense for Demond, because like just touching him in the pocket, like in a real game, like he just runs by you. It's not like, you know, there's some quarterbacks when you touch them, they're going down. That is not the case with Demond. He's
it's
outrunning
like making
everyone.
Van Gogh paint with his feet.
he was generally, you know, they had a failed fourth down on one of their drives, didn't move the ball, did not run the ball particularly well. As excited as we are about the offensive line and you know, the fact that there's just so much more depth there and experience there than there was a year ago after the transfers, I felt like the defensive line pretty comfortably controlled most of this game, which is why it was as low scoring.
It's one of those things
was.
Where you're just like, is this good or is this bad?
Exactly.
And I don't know.
Third Pelton brother Christian Campbell of on Montlake noted he wasn't really sure that, you know, when the last time was the Husky quarterback really had a big spring, because even Michael Penix Jr., you go back to his first spring on campus,
no,
and people were still considering it a competition, which is laughably hilarious in hindsight. Horton was intercepted twice, including a CJ Christian interception on the penultimate play of the first half that saw Jonah Coleman chase him down to prevent a possible pick six. Grady Gross then made a 49-yard field goal at the halftime buzzer. But
this, I did see this. I was in there for that.
At the halftime buzzer, that would have been the longest of his career.
No, I was like, not bad.
I mean, you know, look, we know that one of the things we have learned very well, Jason Myers has been a great example of this during his very long Seahawks career, is that how accurately you kick field goals in one year has basically no correlation with how accurately you kick field goals the next. So the fact that Grady Gross had some struggles midseason this year does not change my opinion about him whatsoever going into next year. Byerly threw a pick six scored by early enrollee Rylan Dillard Allen when he was under pressure from defensive lineman Bryce Butler.
And I mean, Dillard Allen's one of the top prospects from this freshman class as well. So seeing him make a play early on, you know, like Byerly is kind of like, whatever, he's not going to see the field this year, but seeing somebody who might see the field making a play like that, it's pretty cool.
Someone who probably will is spring standout Rayshon Clark, playing a lot at nickelback, a spot where the Huskies have an opening after Jordan Shaw's transfer, forced and recovered a fumble in this one. So that was exciting. He's a Garfield product. You mentioned Raiden Vines Bright, officially 8 catches for 131 yards and a touchdown, including a fourth and two catch.
It's like he's going to be on the field, given those stats. He's going to find his way onto the field.
I mean, it's interesting. So the Huskies played this one without Denzel Boston, Omari Evans, Rashid Williams, and Kevin Green Jr. So, like, pretty much all of your experienced wide receiver depth was not on the field for this. So, it was an opportunity for some of the younger players. They didn't go very deep in their receiver rotation last year. They probably will go somewhat deeper this year with the talent that they have, but will be interesting to see whether he can fight his way on the field. Also, had a 24-yard carry on an end around. In the final minute, Alex McLaughlin, who I've been very excited about and was a little disappointed that he's not running first team at safety, but probably will work in the mix at some point, had a long return of a Kenny McMillan interception, but was also chased down by a running back, in this case, Jordan Washington. Although that one makes a little more sense because Jordan Washington is probably the fastest guy on the entire team. And then the purple team paid it off with a Byerly TD to early enrollee Marcus Harris for their only offensive score.
I think my takeaway is that I think Jed is very excited about Raiden Finds-Bright.
Okay. Well, I mean, I'm excited about it too. His spring was interrupted, had some injury issues. So cool to see him get back on the field and perform that well. In some ways, perhaps the biggest news of the past week for the Husky football program came off the field as Edge Jarrett Coleman-Brusa, the top-ranked prospect in the state of Washington for 2026, who's playing just down the road at Kennedy Catholic, committed to the Huskies after the spring game. His brother Loan is part of the Huskies 2025 recruiting class. So there was some logic to this one, but the competition was stiff. He told Christian Capel in an interview that people around him, he taught. Told this, were said they were surprised, and they expected him to end up at either Ohio State or Oregon, two of the other schools he was considering. That came on the heels of five-star modern day tackle Cody Green flipping his commitment from Oregon
Hello.
to UW. Green spent the first 2 years of his high school at Eastside Catholic, alma mater of Mrs. Fantasy Genius. So a semi-local recruit. And Jed Fish, like, it doesn't mean what it used to in the current college football era, but putting a fence around the state of Washington for the moment. And that's pretty exciting, especially given the talent of these two players.
Yep. I mean, and what it means is they're not just building something for 1 year. This is like Jed is building something right now. And the hope is that you find somebody who can do the pieces of there's a team that we feel like good about next year. A lot of it is spending, right? But in a situation with Jarrett Coleman-Brusa, I highly doubt that they offered him the most money or that, they other teams could have paid him more NIL money, right? Like there are options for those teams to go further. And for them to have basically gamed it out, obviously signing his brother was a factor, but it doesn't seem like it was an instant commit because of that. And to land the number one edge in the country at UW, a team that's had good edge players, but it's not like cornerback in the same sort of way, right? And for this defense, long
It is
term,
not known as DEU.
this could make a huge difference for this defense. And you could kind of project the next couple of years. And I think people could see what Jed is building right now. And he's building a very good program. It's a little bit of spending the right ways, but also it's about the relationships that he's building. He just seems like the kind of dude that people get excited about. People like being around him, which is awesome. And he really wants to bring that energy here. I believe him. And if he's somebody who he can land it and win football games, because there was some stuff he had to figure out last year. Jed did some things wrong during the season.
There's still some things to figure out.
Even the goal line plays in this game, I was like, we're running another fade. I'm like, maybe just take that play and just throw it away. Maybe take the goal line fade and you just burn that one and then we never come back to it because there are a lot better plays in the goal line. But what he is doing overall right now with this program and the excitement around it. Like I said, students. I have never seen students be excited about the team. Students were excited. They were by droves. I've been to a
For the
lot of
record, I
student
have
meetings.
seen students be excited about the team, but it was in the 1990s.
Yeah. Those students don't have the same amount of Grand Slammies left. But for since honestly, since I have been had tickets and been going in 2007, I have not seen students as excited as they are right now, including the last handful of seasons with Michael Penix. I'm not even joking. This is the most excitement from young people at these games that I've ever seen. And that shit works. The thing about him being like, when he said everybody else is not doing spring games, well, we're doing it under the light. Stuff matters.
Yeah. So, I wholeheartedly endorse it.
I don't know. I am so freaking in. And, you know, this commitment is a massive one. Getting a big edge player from Washington, it feels good. Also, the fact that there is like a big edge player, I can't even think of almost anybody. I guess JT Tuimoloau would have been another one, but ended up at Ohio State. And this is somebody who didn't end up at Ohio State.
I feel like, yeah, I guess the notable Husky edges. Who is the edge from Renton? Wasn't there an edge from Renton that was pretty good?
Joe Tryon-Shoyinka.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
I don't know if he was like a big recruit, but
no, I don't think he was a big time recruit for sure. He kind of came out of nowhere.
Like 3 stars. They had a whole generation where defensively they just coached up a lot of players. I don't know where Vita Veo is from. I'm assuming either Hawaii or California, but
right.
They coached up a lot of players in the, you know, basically those Chris Peterson years and took 3-star talent OKGs into players. But this is going out in a big time recruit. You're competing at a national level with. And these are the type of players that you have to land. And they didn't do it. We just saw two of them get drafted this last week, both from Ohio State.
And I don't think I think part of the message is that those two players both went to Ohio State. Huskies played in the national championship. You don't actually have to do it, as it turns out.
Piece to it where you can't take the same thing. Ohio State back then could say, we're in the Big Ten. We have all of this stuff. UW's on the same playing field now. That matters. Being in the Big Ten matters.
I mean, one of the things that's worth remembering is, you know, even though we talk about commit recruiting in terms of programs and, you know, like these broad trends, like ultimately at the end of the day, it's 18-year-olds making decisions. Now, one of the things that didn't happen is, you know, the number of Washington area recruits G. Scott Jr. was not quite as highly touted and did not, I don't think he ended up going in the NFL draft, but he was a very good player in his own right. Like, their older brothers weren't on the roster at UW, as Jared Coleman Brusa has. Maybe some people just want to get away from home. Not everyone wants to stay at home for their college experience. So, you know, Peyton Siva goes to Louisville. That's not like a failing of Lorenzo Robar. Lorenzo Robar recruited
and
many amazing.
What it is mostly is it's a timely reference.
Well, I couldn't say that.
Joe Tryon was a 3-star recruit. But I guess what I will say is that these things can change like the wind. The direction of college football recruiting is blowing towards the Northwest a little bit more than it has in a long time. And money is a big factor in it, obviously. But just who becomes the hot schools overall, it's not even necessarily logical. And I think a lot of it has to do with coaches. It has to do with that more than it does. And whether Jed Fish has been a great recruiter, he was a great recruiter in Arizona, and he's been a great recruiter here. He's able to go in. He got the biggest freaking recruit, a top 10 pick at Arizona, the biggest recruit in their history.
Like, we know the Arizona recruits from that class that are now at UW. We know the Arizona recruits from that class who are now in the NFL. And then one last Arizona recruit is left at Arizona from that class. So look, he definitely did it. And it's
very fascinating what his season's going to look like.
It's exciting to see him start to do the same thing at UW. I am a believer in the OKG kind of philosophy of recruiting. What you don't want to have is, you know, what we saw at times under Rick Neuheisel, where they were so busy chasing the big names that they didn't get, you know, the quality 3-star recruits. But UW is not doing that. A, they got these players. And B, they already have a number of 3-star recruits signed up for the 2026 class. Like, they are not
sacrificing.
And they're
good in the portal. Like, yeah. I just think complete... It's feeling very good right now.
All right, let's wrap up.
All right.
By talking about the Seattle Seahawks, who had their rookie camp over the weekend. Wow. You had to eat your vegetables.
No, this is the time of year, like, when you talk about how you don't have excitement about the draft, where I'm like, the second the draft is over, I'm fine not thinking about the NFL until like August. Maybe late July. There'll be one cold late July day, and it'll be like a cloudy, like Capitol Block Party. It'll be like cloudy on Friday morning, which again, it's one of 2 days Capitol Block Party now. And I'm like, you know what? Football season's coming pretty soon. But
Year round content is not going to create itself.
I'm so fine.
Or is it? I don't know. Maybe it is. The schedule is coming out at some point. But right now, the talking point is that the over-unders for 2025 are out. So from ESPN Bet, the NFC West totals, San Francisco 49ers, 10.5. Los Angeles Rams, 9.5. Arizona Cardinals, 8.5. Seattle Seahawks, 7.5.
Let's do our May over-unders for the NFC West. We can revisit this before the season, obviously, but right now.
I actually feel like I'm under on all of these somehow. I don't think that's mathematically
across the
possible.
Board. Wow, you're just under on the NFC West.
Because like the 49ers, this was a Vegas new situation, I guess I would say.
The Niners at 10.5. That's I get it. And the schedule it's a fourth place schedule for the Niners, right?
Yes.
But they lost a lot of talent on defense.
The Rams, you know, I think are probably somewhat overrated at this point.
The Rams are, what was it, 9.5?
Yeah.
You don't have to be that good to get to 10-7.
I mean, they did last year, so.
And they weren't that good.
Cardinals at 8.5, like, shrug emoji. I mean,
I'm an under on the Niners, probably an over on the Rams. The Cardinals, you said, are 8.5.
Yeah.
Probably an under on the Cardinals and over on the Seahawks.
That's probably the right way to think about it. I need to look more at the Rams before I committed to an over for them. But, yeah, I mean,
they
think
were
the Seahawks,
17th in DVOA last year and still got to 10 wins.
I mean, that's one way to look at it. The Seahawks at 7.5. I think it's probably the right place for them to be. Like, you know, people have noted that there's been a history of the Seahawks hitting the over for a number of years here. The last few years, that was largely connected to people not kind of believing Geno Smith. I think it's more fair at this point. I mean, nobody, like, you shouldn't have believed in Geno Smith before his first season as a starter, I guess I would say. And then I think Vegas was a little slow to update its priors, as perhaps the NFL as a whole was with Geno Smith the last couple of seasons. We'll see, Sam Darnold.
We have the NFC South. This is who the West teams are playing. The NFC South and the AFC South. So probably two of the weakest divisions in football. Right?
Certainly on paper, I would say that, yeah.
And then their extra games are, this is for the Rams, the Baltimore Ravens, the Detroit Lions, and the Philadelphia Eagles. So if there were any argument that you wanted to go under there, I mean, that's all of those games are against, you could, I mean, they likely will be 0-3 in those. So that's three losses right there, and you only need to find four from the rest of the schedule, including, like, they're going to lose games in the NFC West. So
according to Sharp Football Analysis, if you use the over-under totals, the Niners have the easiest projected schedule in the NFL by a considerable margin. Seahawks and Cardinals are 11th hardest, Seahawks 13th hardest, and Rams are 11th easiest, Seahawks 13th easiest, and then Rams 13th hardest.
So yeah. They're all relatively easy. The Rams is worse just because we're playing those South divisions.
Right. The median NFC West schedule is quite easy.
So you're taking the under on everybody probably is wrong.
Well, that's built into the lines.
I guess so. But those lines are pretty similar, I think, to what they would be. Even if they were playing slightly more difficult divisions, I still think those lines would be about what they would be. Honestly, it's a really hard division to predict. And it has been for years and years and years of where everybody will land. For the Seahawks being the lowest, it's a prove it over under.
Of course.
It's an expecting regression to the mean for Sam Darnold, which is fair. And, you know, people really like the draft, but it's a prove it on the draft. And then also that's, you know, they're a bunch of rookies. So, like, they shouldn't affect the over-under that much as players like Darnold and having, you know, Cooper Kupp as your number two receiver, something like that, and the health stuff. So I think it's fine. I still would probably bet the over on the Seahawks. And I don't know, that Niners is kind of compelling on having one of the easiest schedules, but
I want to wait until I see some advanced stats before I weigh in further. But yeah, rookie camp was over the weekend. Didn't seem like there was a lot of notable takeaways from that. Gray Zabel playing left guard as expected. Nick Amonwori playing near the line of scrimmage on defense. Nice. So they are who we thought they were.
I mean, that's fine. I'm so completely over now that the players have been drafted. Any of the conversation about, like, let's just get to liking the players now and being excited about the players. Does that make sense? The draft value stuff is like, it's a conversation to be had in the moment. And to me, I'm kind of like, we had it. We talked about it. It's a thing to file away if the season doesn't go well and your perspective about John Schneider. But beyond that, that's it. We're going to like these players and be excited. If they play well, that's great. We're not going to be thinking during the season about what the draft value of Gray Zabel. If he's the starting left guard and he's playing well, we're just going to be excited about it.
All right. So, well, on that note, I can enjoy my turkey sandwich tomorrow.
How far have you watched all six Andor episodes?
Yes, I have not watched the three that released on Tuesday.
At like 6 p.m.
Third Pilot brother Mia Kynes is already tweeting about episode 8 out here on, or posting about episode 8 here on Blue Sky. So,
ooh, I think that's,
I mean, not spoilers, just okay. like obliquely getting my excitement up.
I was going to say that may be a faux pas.
I mean, I agree. It would be if you did that, but it's just episode 8, few, and then about Denise Goh, or Goo, I don't know how that's pronounced.
So you said from the very beginning, you were like, I'm all in.
I thought that, it's interesting, I felt that this second set of three was a little slower of a burn for me than the first set of three, which I don't know if that's the way that other people experience them.
I mean, I've gone after and read the AV Club reviews, I guess, because they give them a grade, but basically like descriptions, because there's a lot of it where I'm just like, what is going on? I don't know if you do that at all, where like maybe you comprehend everything that's happening.
I don't, although I've, well, yeah, I mean, there was one thing in particular about episode 6 where I didn't interpret it that way in the moment. I've read Ben Lindbergh's analysis on The Ringer. We'll eventually listen to The Midnight Boys. I do not like grades for TV shows because I'm like, I don't need you to give me an opinion on the show. I already have an opinion on the show. I want you to explain what I missed.
Grading it is sort of like not understanding that a like series has an arc, you know? So right. It's kind of like these things are there for a reason.
But I mean, look, Tony Gilroy at this point, I trust. He has earned our trust repeatedly in Andor. And even when, like I said, episode 4 maybe felt like a bit of a slower burn for me, like I knew we were getting to a good place eventually. That wasn't a concern for me. How do you feel about the time jumps?
I was going to say, that's what the critique is kind of like about the time jumps. They're a little bit like not that noticeable to me. Basically, the description from AV Club was like, there's a lot being shoved into these periods of time, but you get there and you're not like, whoa, it's a year later. You know what I mean? Like so much has changed. It's kind of like, this is a natural place to jump forward, and you might jump forward even if it's not like such an explicit time jump. Does that make sense? It could be 6 months. It could be a year.
Right.
TV shows have, you know, they exist over a longer period of time. I know that basically what we need to get to is the show supposed to end right before Rogue One starts?
Well, we started out at 4 BBY, so we'd be 4, 3, 2, 1. So in the Star Wars timeline, Rogue One takes place presumably a few days or a few weeks.
It's like
before.
A week before the events of A New Hope.
Yeah. So,
which I'm watching
I think there
right
will be
now.
A year time jump. Well, I saw that they did it on the rewatchables.
Did they? They did Rogue One?
No, not Rogue One. They did Star Wars.
Star Wars?
They did Star Wars A New Hope.
That's incredible. Oh my God, I'm going to go listen to that right now. Okay, so Rogue One, I watched it when it came out, probably at my lowest interest in Star Wars time ever. I was kind of just like, because it was before the sequels, right?
I think it was before, but it could have been after episode 7, and I'd have to look it up.
And honestly, after watching episode 9, was maybe the lowest my interest in Star Wars has ever been. But I remember watching it, and you just go in with no expectations because I hadn't read reviews or anything like that.
Yeah, it was after The Force Awakens. It was the year in between The Force Awakens and The Last Jedi.
It was one of those movies that just kind of out of nowhere was like, oh my God, this is incredible and actually adds to the story and is interesting in a way. It was like basically the idea was retelling Star Wars in a different way. And that's how I'm so in on Andor that I almost don't care, I guess is what I'm saying about the time jumps, because I'm just like, I like seeing this universe in this way.
Oh, 100%. I want to watch more of this morning show that Edie is watching.
It's like part of it was a little bit too on the nose, you know, like the conversations that they're having that are too timely feel a little bit like on the White Lotus when they had the Trump conversation. You're just like, whoa.
But on the other hand, like, you know, no, like correctly anticipating that it would be this way, you know, in a show that was filmed a while back is more prescient, I would say. Whereas the conversation that was had on the White Lotus could have happened either outcome.
Yes.
This outcome made this season of Andor feel much more on the nose than it would have otherwise. The way that I am thinking about these three episode segments that they're releasing together is that each of them are their own movie.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically what it is.
Yeah, I mean, time-wise, it's that amount, you know, of time is a movie. And then obviously you'd understand that there's going to be a time jump between, you know, episode 7 and episode 8 or episode 4 and episode 5, etc. Like, that's normal. It's just that they don't normally release them a week apart.
I'm so consumed with who has to be where by certain times when I'm watching it, because it's basically like...
No, see, I don't think about that. I mean, I think about the fact that, like, okay, I know that Andor is going to get out of this.
Yeah, but yes. But like, so you watch Rogue One and you're like, they have to take all of these people and they all have to die. You know what I mean? Like, this clump of people, because they're not in A New Hope, they've all got to be gone.
I mean, yes and no, because I do think there's a scenario where there could be, like, one of the things that's interesting about Andor is the way that it projects kind of the fragmented nature of the rebellion, where there's all these different groups that their only connection is they happen to be getting calls from someone who they have never met, have only talked to via radio, that we know is Stellan Skarsgård.
But, oh yeah, definitely played.
I mean, I think he might be my single favorite actor. Like, it might be my single favorite combination of actor and role in any Star Wars.
Oh my God, Krennic is so good though. Like,
no, I'm not. No, he's way up there. Don't get me wrong.
Seeing Krennic in Rogue One, it's funny going back and watching Rogue One, because I know, like, I was watching Rogue One. I don't know what Krennic is, right? Like, I'm just like watching. It's like, oh, here's nameless, faceless bad guy of the week. And then you watch this, and you're like, that dude is scary.
I needed to see him looking at art.
But the second to last line, when the Luthen says in episode 6, I don't know how much spoilers we're going to have. I guess, should we just say all spoilers? Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. But when he's like, we probably should have just killed him. And I'm like, that was so good.
He said that.
And I was like, I'm so in. And then the big explosion happening after, I know there are some people who are a little bit, I didn't see that coming at all.
Zero.
I didn't even like read a bit about there being an explosion, but the way that they set it up, and you kind of forget about it, it's kind of like offhanded, right? That they're talking about the doctor being promoted, and then all of a sudden you're like, oh, okay. Like, those things, it kind of like And maybe that's would be a criticism about the time jump, but I don't like things being too telegraphed. You know what I mean?
No.
When you're watching White Lotus and you're like, okay, this is what's going to happen. 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 And I mean, it's a show that we know who's going to die most likely. Because again, you could see all the media after it, but it's kind of like the mechanisms to get there is what's fun.
Cinta's death, unfortunately, was pretty telegraphed in episode 6, I would say. Do you not think so?
Wait, who is this? Remind me. Oh, yes. No, yeah, we definitely knew that. Yeah.
Yeah, that was pretty obvious. The thing that Van Lindberg mentioned was that he interpreted is this was Cassie and Bix going rogue to kill Dr. Gorst. And see, when I watched the episode, I assumed that the flashing light that Bix saw, the kind of order from Stellan Skarsgård, who I forget what his name even is, and I don't care.
Luthen Rail.
Luthen, that's right. He's just always Stellan Skarsgård.
I think he's really is Luthen though. Like you,
I mean,
you
know, I'm not saying Stellan he doesn't Skarsgård. Inhibit the role. I'm just saying.
It is funny though, because I'm like, he's Diego Luna and he's Cassian Andor, but like, I still can see him as both in the same way that Stellan Skarsgård, like he is when he's there. I'm like, that's Luthen. He has that kind of like the boss power.
But yeah, I mean, to your point earlier, there's just so many entertaining set pieces along the way. So Cassian cosplaying is the designer.
Oh, he
and
was
then
so
slipping
good
in and out of that in his conversation.
Yeah, no, I thought that like the outfits for that, they freaking nailed it. And the conversations on Gorman, which again, like I love that they took sort of like the little nugget from, and I always imagine all these other people. If you're George Lucas, I have no idea how much George Lucas actually, and I'm sure this is documented somewhere, but it's not a thing I know, like really had these kind of backstories, or it's just a thing that's mentioned, you know? I mean, and just
the ultimate is obviously like that Luke and Leia were not brother and sister in the first movie.
I think there's a lot of like retroactive, you know, going back and filling these stories. But
the term is retconning.
The Gorman stuff in particular, where it's just so casually mentioned, and then it's a huge part of the story, and there's the monument, and people are like affected by it. And that's the piece that when you watch Star Wars, right? Like they call it the Skywalker saga or whatever now, those 9 movies, it is so much about, it's about the Force and it's about the Jedi. And now when you watch those, it seems kind of stupid. Just like how much of it is about this, like, this group of people that are sort of like when you're thinking about it practically of like who the good guys are and who the bad guys are, the Jedi almost feel like they fit in like a different subset, and they don't seem immediately like the good guys anymore. And I think
certainly
part of this,
not after watching whatever the series was with Manny Jacinto.
I don't even know.
Did
you
watch that
of
one?
No, what is it? Ahsoka?
The Acolyte.
Obi-Wan Kenobi? The Acolyte? I don't even know what you're talking. Okay. Is this a Star Wars show?
Yeah. I guess it wasn't the most recent one. It was last year, though.
Literally didn't even know this existed. I mean, there's a bunch of Star Wars content that I'm just not interested in at all. I was interested in Andor. You know, everybody was talking about how it was, and I just was sick one day and turned it on. I was like, oh, crap, this is actually phenomenal. So, but it does kind of go back, and like the Rebellion don't seem like the good guys explicitly. It all is just muddy. And yeah. I think that's the best part about it. But again, like just seeing the world on a granular level and how people are acting in it, that's what I've been so in on. But both of the seasons of Andor. And they're also just really good at acting, everybody involved.
Yeah.
But okay, watching Rogue One, I know that he's like there for comic relief and he's supposed to be like your favorite character. K2SO is the best droid in all of Star Wars. Like BB-8 can go fuck himself. And obviously the classic like droids. K2SO, just everything he says, and I'm like, I know what you're doing and I hate that it works. But watching Rogue One, you know what I mean? It's one of those things where you're like, oh, I'm so mad at how good this is.
That's fair.
So
I am wondering.
I'm excited.
What happened to
I'm hoping
emo.
He gets there.
Oh, okay.
He's from Gorman. He's He was reprogrammed from the Gorman massacre.
Huh. Okay. I did not remember that.
So I'm like, if we get a little glimpse of him. Because again, I was watching it and I completely forgotten that Destroyed existed. And I was like, oh my God, that dude rules. So it's definitely one of those things where I'm like, this is an amazing character. I don't know. Tony Gilroy's got the juice, you know, and I wish that there were more stories being told around Star Wars universe, because it doesn't have to be Star Wars. It's just a fun universe to tell these stories in. And there's exactly. The overarching story to kind of fill in. And so many people have done it wrong or just boring too. You know, that was kind of my main complaint about. Like, I watched some Mandalorian, and I'm like, I just don't care. And that's not the way that I feel about it. Like, I care about what's happening in Andor.
I thought the first two seasons of Mandalorian were good, but then it definitely kind of lost the plot a little bit in the most recent season. So anyways, to my point earlier, because of the fact that the Rebellion is so decentralized, I do think there's a scenario where even though we don't see Bix in Rogue One or even hear about her, it doesn't necessarily mean to me that she has to die in this season of Andor. Like, there could be a world where
very rosy way to view it, but I think everybody who is not in Andor is probably going to die, but that's fine. Like, it doesn't make it bad. In the same way that you watch Rogue One, you're like, I know all these people are going to die somehow, but it's kind of fun to see how it happens, and it's like, all the people have to get to this planet, and it's got to be destroyed.
Yeah.
But the conversation, also the conversation between Mon Mothma and Krennic, was like, it was the best. Like, it was seriously up there with anything in Star Wars history. Because again, a lot of Star Wars, when you go, it's obviously, like people have said this a million times, it's like a children's movie. Yes. And this did not feel like that. So no. Even like the great moments from Star Wars are kind of like, now, like when it was exciting, it feels stupid. Also, I'm prequel person, so I'm all in on prequels. Like, my favorite Star Wars movie is Revenge of the Sith. So it's common for people from my generation. Thank you.
You're not a different generation from me.
No, I've looked it up extensively. We are the same generation. Despite how Gen X you seem.
Do I seem Gen X? Do I hate selling out?
You're always hacking the sack.
Do I smoke cigarettes?
But no, I think it was legitimately like one of the best like confrontations that's happened. Oh, and it's like, fun to see those
bars that much.
Right? It's fun to see those moments because they really don't happen aside from being like the conversations between like Luke and Darth Vader they're like, what is the word that I'm looking for? They're like pushing
mirrored by the White Lotus.
Does that make sense? Like, yes. They're always trying to achieve something in a way that, or like provide backstory, you know, but it's not just like them going, and then they fight. And this is just like a dialogue between the two.
I mean, what I thought was interesting about episode 6 is like basically every line, there's some level of deceit in every line that gets spoken between one person and another. Like,
oh, when Cyril, I didn't know what was going, like when he was doing the whole thing and I was like, wow, he's really, I was like, good for my boy.
Oh no, I mean, I knew that.
But when it was first happening, I had
but how
no
much
idea.
He actually knows, we didn't know.
I think he's great. The AV Club loves him. He's like their favorite character.
I mean, I don't dislike Cyril. I wouldn't say he's my favorite character. And in the guy, why am I forgetting Mon Mothma's husband's name? Everything he says makes me laugh.
Oh,
I just find him hilarious.
Wait, hold on. AV Club. So the two lines. God, when Cyril's like,
is Mon Mothma's husband.
When he was like, would it ruin the moment to say this is the best moment of my life? You're just like,
oh yeah.
Beautiful, so good. Kind of annoyed about Benjamin Bratt.
In what sense?
That it's not Jimmy Smits.
I think he might be a little too old for this role at this point.
Scheduling conflict.
Oh, was that it?
Yes.
Huh.
We should have killed Krennic while we were up there. So good. Okay, wait. I want to find the other line that I just like Oh, okay. Yeah. Really? It's an assignment. Ah, I'm going to do that again. Really? It's an assignment. Calibrate your enthusiasm. And I was just like, yes.
It's a great line. Yes.
Yeah, I also find
Partagaz
hilarious. Oh, it's so good. Again, we didn't like, they are nameless and I know everybody said this. This is not new, but like, they're nameless and faceless in Star Wars. You know, like, they're always the best villains, right? The dark side is always the best villains, but it's not because of the interactions that they have. They just look the coolest and they have the coolest lightsabers.
Right.
So, another thought that I had.
Might put a red lightsaber in your social media post on May 4th.
Yikes. Was the... Oh, God. Wait, what was I thinking? So, when we were kids, the number one movie, like, media bad guy in the entire world was Darth Vader, in my opinion. And he has been... I will say this is one of the negative things that happened during the prequel, my prequels, was Darth Vader being so humanized. And I think this was intentional to basically like give the backstory. Like, Vader is supposed to be like a sympathetic character more than he is supposed to be pure evil. But we grew up and it was like Darth Vader was pure evil. That was it. It was the number one evil.
I don't know if I necessarily thought of it in those terms, but like the scariest.
Oh, absolutely. And now it's just completely moved to Palpatine. And it's kind of like, it just, he doesn't quite have
Rogue One in particular, if we're talking about scary.
No, that's what I was saying. Rogue One was like, Vader is the scary, but also, I don't know, just watching it as an adult, you're just like, he kind of looks like a person wearing a stupid costume. But Darth Vader is still like, just badass in that movie. And that's what I really like about it, to just show Darth Vader just fucking shit up, you know? Because we haven't gotten that in a long time. So... Because no matter what, like when you're playing a video game or whatever, right? When you're playing Star Wars Battlefield, you always want to be Vader. He's number one. And it kind of sucks in culture that it's been completely moved to Palpatine, because he doesn't have the goods. Palpatine's scary, but it's not like the way that interpersonally, if you came upon Darth Vader, that is the scariest person you could come upon.
Agreed.
Anyway, I'm excited for the rest. I'm really excited about it.
The second scariest person you can come across is if you're an A's pitcher in the ninth inning, Cal Raleigh.
Hello.
Full circle.
Send lawyers, guns, and money.
Thanks for listening.
Oh, thanks for doing that still. Thanks for listening.